I'm Anthony Brooks. This is a special episode of On Point with Tom Ashbrook. Yesterday, Tom was in San Francisco, and he sat down with Airbnb's head of global policy and public affairs, Chris Lehane, to talk about how we can embrace disruption. Here's his interview.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here. Yes, a little dynamite in surveying work in Alaska, and I still think of On Point Jarl as a stick of dynamite in NPR's program lineup every single day. So, and my kung fu moves don't get me started. I mean, do not get me started. I learned from the masters. It's really great being with you here. We are here at an extraordinary time. We'll talk about disruption. We all know that's happened and continues to happen. Chris Lehane and I were just talking, and he has told me that what we've seen so far is just a lemonade stand out front of the disruption to come. So hang on to your hats for our conversation here today. It's also a time like no other that I have seen in my now longish journalistic career. I was just up watching on CNN as our president of the United States stood with the rather authoritarian leader of Poland right now and on foreign soil denounced the fake news, again, in very strong terms. I could not be more proud to do what I and many others do every single day on NPR, in this country, and around the world. We bring the facts. We give voice to Americans in every city and town and country crossroads across this nation. It is essential journalism for our republic, for our democracy, our country, and it is not in any way fake news. And though I can't believe it, it is now important to say that, and I think we should all be saying it and understanding what that means and standing up to do it and do it always and do it just as well as we know how. I am so delighted to be with you and to have Chris Lehane with us today. We all know that the world has changed radically in the last 20 years due to digital technology. In the 1990s, I was one of the top editors at the Boston Globe. I was turning 40 years old. I looked at the internet coming. I looked at the future of newspapers. I realized I didn't want to be one day like an aging priest in a dying religion. I left newspapers in 1996, started an internet company, raised $70 million, did the whole internet thing. It was an amazing education. Wrote a book about that and was starting a second company on the day, as Jarl says, of 9/11. We were headed down to Lower Manhattan to raise money for the next firm. We stopped off in Connecticut, got the call, something's happening there. We watched as the towers came down in a venture capital firm in Connecticut. I'd taken a sort of a respite from journalism at that time. And a couple days later, got the call from NPR through WBUR, can you help? And thank God I did. Print was fantastic, but man, do I love radio. There is nothing more intimate than audio, however you deliver it. And I have every confidence that unlike the paper and ink that I used to work with, audio is a medium that if we handle it right, no matter what the disruptive threat that's out there, if we handle it right, it is always going to be as elementally attractive to human beings as the campfire and the conversation with those that we love and know and want to hear from. So I have great confidence at that very basic level, and I couldn't be happier to be in radio right now. Chris Lehane. This is an incredible guy from Airbnb. His background, he's learned to read. He just told me reading the Boston Globe when they were in the World Series in 1975. Grew up, was born around Boston, grew up in Portland, Maine. Went to Harvard Law School and then got right into the thick of American politics. He was a big kind of Mr. Fix-It, get it done, street fighter guy for Bill Clinton. 6 years during the Clinton administration. He was lead spokesman for Al Gore in his 2000 presidential campaign. He's worked for Andrew Cuomo at HUD. A couple of years ago, Airbnb had exploded. You may not remember, but Airbnb was born, just 10 years ago, maybe not even, about 8 blocks from here when a couple of guys rented out 3 air mattresses in their apartment. And people, when there was a big conference here and hotel rooms were short, they rented out 3 air mattresses and today they are Airbnb, a $30 billion company. We'll talk about that with Chris Lane. The disruptors, who are they? You know them. They're Facebook and Google and Amazon and Uber and Airbnb. They are changing the world that we live in. Chris Lane is right in the middle of it as their global policy guru. He's out all over the country and the world arguing the Airbnb case because they've got headwinds, even themselves, even disruption is not dead easy. He's right in the thick of it. He also happens to be a huge public radio fan. Please join me in welcoming Chris Lane.
Thank you, sir.
Sir.
I thought we did a little kung fu.
Yeah, we'll do that later if you want. Thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, let me just say thank you so much for having me here. Jarl, thank you so much for your stewardship over these great institutions. I know there's been a tremendous amount of success since you've come on board. And Tom, thank you for having me. As you mentioned, I am from New England. Grew up listening to BUR.
Yes.
And so it's very special to be here. So thank you very much for having me, and thank you for all your success. I mean, I've listened to the program growing up, and I always listen to it, and like many other NPR and public television outlets, I always feel smarter at the end of the day. But also, do want to thank everyone here, because I think what you said earlier is really right. We live in incredibly challenging and complex times. I think democracy is challenged, and I think in some places suffering from some illness. And I think a robust fourth estate, and in particular the role that public television, public radio plays, is absolutely critical to that. We don't have referees or umpires anymore, and if you don't have commonality of facts, hard for trust to exist in a democracy to succeed. So you play an incredibly important role. So for me, thank you for everything that you all do.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. We will circle back and talk exactly, precisely about that role. The theme of this entire luncheon is disruption, and you are you represent a major instrument of disruption. But take us to Airbnb first. Your world headquarters is just a few blocks from here. Give us a sense right now. I mean, it started it took them a while to get it off the ground, but I think the first air mattress rental was 2007. What's the scale of Airbnb today, just 10 years later?
It's great. You're right. It's 2008. You had three founders. Two of the three were art school graduates from RISD up in New England and Rhode Island. And they were working as designers here in San Francisco and had a difficult time making their rent. This is right as the economy was crashing and people were facing all sorts of challenges. And they came up with an idea. There was an art conference for a weekend. They said, well, we have some air mattresses. Let's blow them up and get people some bagels, donuts, orange juice, and coffee and see if we can get a couple folks to stay over. They did it. Made their rent that month. Sort of an idea popped up. Maybe we're onto something. And soon they created an internet site. And they began to advertise shared rooms. And then from there, whole houses. Today you can do tree houses. You can do igloos. If you're so interested, we had Count Dracula's castle available on Halloween last year. The entire country.
I don't know if I'm brave enough.
The entire country of Sweden a couple weeks ago. But you know, today we are blessed to have 180 million arrivals on the platform.
What does that mean? 180 million.
That means how many people have traveled, actually stayed as a guest.
180 million. Wow.
We're in 65,000 plus cities. Keeps me pretty busy. 191 countries. Actually, easier to name the places that we're not in. I think a big part, and we can certainly get into this, part of our success has been that I do think we are delivering an incredible value proposition for the world. We can talk about that if you want, but yes, it's been an incredible, and this is in 8 years.
On that night when they blew up the air mattresses 8 blocks from here, do you think Mr. Hilton and Mr. Marriott trembled?
No, I don't think that they were that worried about the air mattresses. Today, however, we're bigger than the top three hotel chains put together. And if you think about it, on New Year's Eve of this year, we had around 2 million people stay at an Airbnb, which is a record, at least to the best of our knowledge, for any accommodation company. On a weekly basis, on a typical night, we'll have 1 million-plus people. And, you know, in a time period when people are talking about building walls and closing doors and shutting windows, we do think it's pretty incredible that you have at times 1 million-plus, 2 million-plus people staying in a stranger's home.
Opening doors.
And I think that, you know, it does say something positive about our higher angels.
We've got a lot of people here who work with the business side of public radio. Could you just explain the business model of Airbnb? How does it work? I rent a house. I've done this here in San Francisco. Okay, what happens with the money?
Yeah, so the way it works on the platform is that you control an asset, which is your home, either as a homeowner or as a renter. You come on the platform, we do a pretty thorough vetting because we do want to protect for safety, quality, security. And then your home is on the platform, and you can
determine. You have a policy that you can't leave running cameras in your home.
That's right. That's, we have a bunch of.
Good.
By the way, part of the fascinating thing, that sidebar for a second, is you're developing all of this in real time. We're sort of building the car, building the road, building the rules of the road. Some people are throwing rocks as you do all of this. But all that is happening in real time. So issues like that, right, that no one would have imagined necessarily. When you had three millennials making their air sofa beds available in 2008, right? You're dealing with in a pretty significant way when you get to those numbers.
I saw that policy is only a couple years old, and I was thinking back to my early Airbnb rentals and just, never mind.
It may have been the kung fu films. It may have been different types of films. Yeah. But so if you list your property or home on Airbnb, you make 97% of the money by which you list your home for. And part of our growth really was a function of the fact that post-2008, when people were really facing, what I think we now see today as an earning crisis, typical American
individuals across the
individuals,
country.
Right? Typical middle-class families about $4,000 behind where they would have been otherwise, given historic growth rates, that Airbnb was one of those things that they were able to do to begin to make up that difference. Then you got something called a network effect, which is a highfalutin Silicon Valley word, but it's basically when you really have both a supply and demand, a consumer and a host market that really is working in an incredibly efficient way. And I think part of the key for us is that those hosts are making 97% of the money. It is, and we obviously drink our own Kool-Aid, but this is a democratizing of capitalism. Most capitalist structures exist where the entity that controls the supply chain makes the vast majority of the wealth, regardless of whether they're responsible for the creation of it or not. On Airbnb, the vast majority is being made by those actual hosts, 70%+ of whom are middle-class folks, 55% of whom are women. Really challenging to find an economic sector, except low-end, where the women are the majority. They've made over $10 billion on the platform.
You can hear that a political guy has been brought into a disruptive company. This isn't just business. This is the democratization of capitalism. who can argue with that?
See?
Huh? That 3%, is that all you make, or is there? Is that?
So we make 3% on the host, and then we typically will charge the guest 9%. So on a $100 a night listing, we would be making $12 off of it. The host would make $97. They pay us $3, and then the guest would pay $9 on top of the $100. So
I saw people were celebrating because Uber only lost $750 million in the first quarter of this year, only. And I don't know about if it keeps going. I don't know. How are you doing?
Well, we're always very careful about talking about economics and finances. I would certainly point to public reports, which have indicated that the company is...
Wow, you've been with Al Gore.
Yes. The public reports indicate that the company is doing, we're doing well and pleased about where we are.
Okay. A public... Awesome. Great. I saw you've got $10 billion.
I know you don't want to get me in trouble with the SEC, so I'm being very careful here.
But you're not in the IPO channel yet.
No, not in an explicit way.
Nope. Your job.
See, I danced.
We all saw the dance. You're naked, man. You're just naked in front of this. They know. You were brought on. I read there was an urgent call to your kid's soccer game, and Airbnb suddenly needed an ass kicker.
So this is.
And they called you. What was their problem? Why did they call you?
So it's a little bit of a funny story. I'll bore you for 20 seconds.
No, you won't.
So I was on my way to a kid's baseball game, Little League game, right? Okay. And I had the whole Little League outfit.
See, there
on,
it was,
right?
Fake news. I said soccer. No, I meant baseball. I'm sorry. Baseball. Yes. I stand corrected. I'll publish it.
And so I get this call from a friend of mine over Airbnb who had previously worked for me in the Clinton administration. Hey, can you bop over here? We have an issue. And at the time, San Francisco, some folks here were looking to qualify a ballot initiative, which would have been very restrictive.
A ballot initiative would have been
very restrictive in terms of how home sharing could have worked in San Francisco.
People would have had to register.
All sorts of onerous things. It was really designed to make it really, really hard for those folks to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll come by after the game. And so I come by, and I never really had been in their new offices, which were 888 Brandon. By way of context, and I didn't know this at the time, every space in the office is a replica of some type of room somewhere in the world, right? And so I get over there, the elevator takes me up, and I go into this very sort of circular room that looks like an awful lot like the Dr. Strangelove room from the movie. And there's a very large crowd in there, and people are all looking at me. And I say, trying to break the ice a little bit, hey, this looks like the Dr. Strangelove room. They all looked at me like I was nuts, because in fact, it is an exact replica of that.
So were you doing the Sam What's-His-Name? Yeah,
yes, yes. I basically came in as like the Mr. Fix-It, and my first statement was essentially the equivalent of saying, the sun comes up in the east, look at that, right?
Brilliant guy.
Right? It felt like Mr. Wolf in, you know,
well,
in Pulp Fiction.
Weird,
yes, yeah, put the body in the trunk. You know,
why does it look like that? They don't rent out the Dr. Strangelove's pad.
Because there's a number of rooms. We actually have a room that looks exactly like the bridge of the Star Trek Enterprise ship. So we have fun with the various rooms. I would welcome
one day,
anyone and everyone.
You can have this too.
Yes, to come by. We could do it. You know, we could create an NPR studio over there. It would be perfect. Yes.
But they needed you to come in because, I mean, you had run interference more than that. You were a street fighter for Bill Clinton. You'd been with Tom Steyer fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. You had worked on Californian issues and taken sides. And was it just for San Francisco? What's happened to that role?
It was initially for San Francisco. That led to a longer relationship. But I'll tell you the sort of fascinating exchange I had with our founder and CEO, Brian Chesky. Mm-hmm. So we're in this room, and you know, I walk through how you would typically win a ballot initiative, and I've done a bunch of them here in California and around the country. And with typical ballot initiatives, especially when you're on the no side, which is what we would have been on, there's a yes and there's a no, you really run a pretty negative campaign mm-hmm. to drive voters to a no.
Punch them hard.
Punch them hard, right? And Brian said to me, and I really remember this, which is, that's not really consistent with how we, and these are my words, not exactly mm-hmm. his words, but you know, we're really a values-based company. That's not how we think about doing things. We want to make this an affirmative. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but this is a yes or a no, and yes is bad, no is good for us. And he said, well, you know, go back and think about this. And I went back, and I spent a couple days, and I actually began to look at some of the data. And what I had not realized fully at the time was that in San Francisco, there was about 140,000, 150,000 people who are voters here who are actually on the platform. Not as
who
hosts.
Who are renting out there.
But some of them as hosts, a smaller subset, but who had used it to travel.
Yeah.
And it suddenly
liked it.
And who really liked it. And it suddenly clicked in that, hey, there's sort of an interesting community here. Mm-hmm. You were looking at a voter pool that was probably only going to be around 150,000 to 175,000 voters, and so could we put in place a different type of a ballot initiative campaign that was all built around organizing this community? Mm-hmm. And we actually ended up doing that. We won by double digits.
Build a vanguard of people with an interest in your success.
And we actually had our hosts go door to door targeting people who had been guests on the platform, asking them to participate in the election. And, you know, initial polling had shown us to be fairly substantially behind, ended up winning by a pretty wide margin. And it was because those people turned out. And it really clicked on as I went through that process that what Brian had said was right, which is that, you know, this platform, and again, we drink our Kool-Aid, but there is a community that is organizing itself around the platform. When we're 8 years old, and in a YouGov study at the end of last year, we had the highest brand identity amongst our consumers than any brand in the world.
Highest positive rating
positive
or
identity.
Just awareness?
Positive
identity.
Yeah, we actually have lower awareness, but very high brand identity and affiliation with those who use it. Part of that is because people are making economics off of it. Part of it is because of the experience they have when they travel.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you come to disruption, and part of it is you have created a new way for people who have homes or apartments, houses, igloos, to find a new revenue stream. We get that. But there's the other side of this. What are Airbnb users, consumers, looking for? What's the hunger that Airbnb has ridden to such amazing success on that side? There's plenty of hotel rooms out there in the world.
That's a great question. And, you know, at the core of the idea has been, you know, this concept that anyone can belong anywhere. And I think once you sort of get below that, you know, what you're really tapping into is people want to have, you know, authentic, unique, real experience. They want to go to a San Francisco and go to a real San Francisco neighborhood and experience that local San Francisco coffee shop, that local restaurant, sometimes staying with a host who can actually almost provide a sort of concierge on hand.
I thought you were looking for cheap digs.
And that's part of it, too. So we just that was a nice setup, by the way. We just released a study going in July 4th showing that, you know, typical Airbnb listing in the U.S. Was about $100 less a night than a hotel. So as travel and tourism grows, right, 10% of global GDP growing faster than most other sectors of the economy, more and more people are traveling, mm-hmm. And they're looking for something that gives them a different type of an experience. Mm-hmm. but also something that's more affordable. So you stay in an Airbnb, you get free Wi-Fi. You don't have to pay for that, mm-hmm. right? You get a washer and dryer. I have 10 and 12-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I definitely need a washer and dryer with my two boys. Mm-hmm. Right? You sometimes get a yard. You get more bedrooms.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so you're getting more for less and getting a really unique experience. And you know, our growth began initially with millennials. And those millennials, which I'm sure everyone in this room is thinking about and experience, right? They're going to be 75%+ of the key demographic over the next 10 years, 50%+1%, if not more, of voters, right? They're going to be shaping our world, which, by the way, I think is a good thing ultimately.
Me too.
A really good thing given where we are right now.
Because they listen to On Point, I love them.
See, there you go, right? See, I gave a setup back. Wasn't that nice?
Thank you.
Yes, yes. But those millennials, you know, are really looking for those types of both an accessibility, affordability, but also an experience. And final little piece here.
Yeah.
We actually did some survey work and sort of looked at how millennials were thinking about us and how they thought about hotels. And the interesting thing is when they look at what the hotels are actually advertising, we were talking about this before, those hotel ads are almost negative ads for those millennials.
What aspect of it?
Because so think of an ad that shows you going and staying in a sort of antiseptic room, mm-hmm. Staying with people who sort of look like you do, eating the same food that you already can eat,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you're going to a San Francisco or a Paris or a Havana, Cuba,
yeah.
or a Mexico City, right, you want to actually have a different kind
Let's
of
feel
experience.
It.
And for those millennials, you know, this is a different generation, particularly than the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Baby boomers are really focused on using resources for material gain, all sorts of benefits from that. But these millennials are looking at spending their resources on experiences.
Yes.
They're very collective. They're very collaborative.
Yeah.
Very values-driven. They actually believe that something should deliver a value before they're going to use the consumer product. And I think as we can talk about this also later, as this group begins to think about your next chapters, how that audience plays into what you're delivering, because I think you really align with their values.
I want to come again to disruption, but let's think about it in terms of who you disrupted. I mean, your market cap is now estimated at like $30 billion. That is twice Hilton's. That's about as big as Marriott. Marriott's gigantic and been around forever. How are they responding? I mean, I've seen you're out fighting fires all over the country, around the world now. This is maybe a difference in the broadcasting, podcasting space. It's not so much an issue of regulation or local resistance to new entrants.
Yeah.
But in your case, you are disrupting the same way Uber disrupted the taxi system. And you've now got the hotel industry really coming after you. They went to New York and they got the governor and the New York City on their side and came after you. I mean, they claim that, I forget, one recent year, Airbnb cost hoteliers almost $500 million in New York City alone.
Yeah.
They're after you now. So what's your challenge?
So a couple of things. First of all, as I said, you know, travel and tourism is growing. The hotel industry has had their four best years from both a profit, revenue, and in terms of how many people are staying at them from a rate perspective.
So we
would, you know, generally say that there's a pretty big pie and it's growing out there quicker than can even be handled by the current industry. So there's a way for everyone to do very well. You are right, though, which is they are coming after us. There was a front page or big New York Times story earlier this spring that talked about how the hotel industry had come together and were organizing a global campaign to really go after Airbnb. And ultimately, that's going after middle-class hosts, right? That's ultimately going after the product that we are offering, which we do think is a great product for folks, especially for those middle-class people who are traveling. But what's really going on with the hotel industry, and this gets back to when you know I talked about the price differential, is the hotel business model is based on something where they basically try to limit the supply of rooms so that they can raise prices.
Mm-hmm.
It's called compression nights. Compression nights, as a hotel CEO actually acknowledged. In Washington, D.C., we have a phrase, which is a gaffe is unintentionally saying what you really believe, right?
Yeah.
This hotel, John Bortz, who owns a bunch of hotel chains, said, in effect, yes, we're concerned about Airbnb because, quote, unquote, you may say that it actually impacts our ability to continue to gouge consumers. He used the word gouge. Public earnings call.
Well, they used to love it when there was a big conference in town.
Yes.
They would jack their rates.
Jack their rates.
And they could do it. With you guys, they can only...
They can't do that, right?
We disagree.
Now, look, there's supply and demand works. Right? We're not against supply and demand. There's the laws of economics. But artificially limiting supply allows you to jack up prices. And that is how the hotel model has worked for a long, long time. They're also concerned on the millennials, right? They look at those millennials. They know that we're the first choice. And those millennials are going to be the dispositive consumer cohort out there. Mm-hmm. And how do they sort of manage for that as they go forward? For us, you know, we are a new thing. I always do point out, though, that home sharing existed before hotels. Hotels actually disrupted home sharing. That's how people used to travel. I mean, when Abe Lincoln traveled around on his circuit, he stayed in people's homes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Okay. But he used to board with my Aunt Polly
right, yeah, there
in
you
Salem.
Go. But now it's on a digital platform, right? And so the digital platform, because this is now an infrastructure to really make put this in a global sense, you know, has really
been... Who can be against Airbnb?
Right.
Abe Lincoln used
it. Yeah, Abe Lincoln used it, see? Talk about our higher angel. See, yeah, I tied it all in. But over a digital platform is new, and you know, in most of these cities, which historically have had jurisdiction over regulating this type of activity, there's no sort of set of existing rules, and so you know, we're in effect having to go in and work with cities to put in place those new
rules.
Well,
now you are, since you're successful. At first, it was just what was the lingo was, you know, just do it and ask permission later.
Yeah, you know, and it's an interesting question, right? There is a little bit of a chicken and the egg. Would anyone have really answered the door in 2009,
no, they wouldn't.
Right?
But now you're out there negotiating city by city. And how's that going?
So we have 350 partnerships that we've put in place really over the last year or so. And I think I've gotten, you know, really pretty good at knowing the types of tools that we need to put in place.
What do they want? They want tax revenues? They want a guarantee of clean sheets? What do they
want? That's right. So the tax piece typically ends up being a really big piece. In a lot of places, particularly in the U.S., there's something called a hotel or tourist tax that cities apply when you stay at a hotel. And about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I actually stood in front of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. It's about 250 big city, 300 mayors. And I said, I'm going to say something that probably no private sector entity has ever said before. Read my lips. We want to pay our taxes. I had to say it twice because it was like dead silence at first because I don't think it really...
What did he say?
Yes, what did he say, right? And so since then, you know, here in the U.S., we've done 250 tax partnerships. Almost 60% of our community in the U.S. is under these tax regimes, producing great money. L.A. is using it for affordable housing, Chicago for children's homelessness. So we are finding revenue that... But what's really telling, though, about the hotels is that the hotel industry, that was their initial call. Airbnb needs to pay taxes. Now they're opposed to us paying taxes.
Oh, because it legitimizes
Absolutely, yes.
You guys are incorrigible.
Yeah, that's good.
All right. I want to think about public broadcasting, public radio.
Yep.
You are a public radio listener.
Absolutely. Every morning. For a couple reasons. I think, you know, first of all, the quality of the content. I mean, I'm, as anyone in this room, I'm a news hounder. I'm getting all my updates over social. I don't need to get updated on what's going on. I would like a deeper, more thorough analysis by people who've spent some time really thinking about this and being able to leverage experts who have a real knowledge. I think secondly, and you touched on this in your earlier remarks, you know, there is something that is really personal about whether it's in your car or, you know, I'll tell you what a geek I am. I sometimes will download things and do it while I work out. But, you know, having
it's not
those...
so geeky. Lots
you
know, of people do
having
that.
Those conversations
a lot
and listening to them. I was telling the story earlier. You know, I am a huge fan of any number of NPR, but, you know, of Fresh Air. And I will often save... We have a place up in Calistoga. It's about an hour, 20-minute drive from here. I save those for the drive,
absolutely.
Right? But the quality of that content... I also think, as I said earlier, you know, we are in a time period where I do fundamentally believe democracy is being challenged. And that, you know, there are limited places that you can go to where you're actually getting the types of facts that you can take action against or understand or apply. And the quality of what you get from both public broadcasting, from NPR, from the various outlets here, you know, really is hard to compete with anywhere else. And then third, it's just, I mean, I'm not saying this just because you are here. There's any number of folks, you know, Michael Krasny here in Forum, KQED, who's a friend and on regularly, but they're entertaining. They're really smart conversations. They're fun to listen to.
We hope so.
Yep.
But now, I mean, with newspapers, here came bloggers. They flooded the zone pretty soon, and here came Craigslist and everything else pretty soon. They couldn't raise, they couldn't sell classified ads, and the deployment newsrooms have shrunk. I mean, they're really a shadow of what they were. Think about public radio and public broadcasting. It's not exactly analysis to hotels and Airbnb, but now there are podcasts everywhere. There are new aggregators of podcasts. What's to keep NPR public radio from being taken down the same kind of notch that newspapers were, if anything?
Well, I would say, and this may be a strained analogy, but I do think that there, you have one thing that we also have. We provide a product that consumers really want, both on the host side and on our traveler side, which is that authentic, unique experience, the economics they get from it. You're providing something that people are desperate for right now, which is high-quality content. You know, it's an old line that content is king. I think that's more so now than ever before. So the question to me is, you know, how do you continue to provide highly curated, incredibly bright, smart content, but take it to where people are getting their information from now that continues to work, you know, with your business model. So compared to maybe the hotels, you still have a product.
People want more and more.
I mean, you look at the millennial data on news and information. Oh, yeah. They want information. And, you know, I can think of any number of examples, and we were talking about some of this earlier, but, you know, I go back to, you know, cereal from a couple of years ago. I still remember the sponsor, you know, Chimp Mayo, MailChimp, right?
Of course.
I don't remember many sponsors unless I actually paid for it myself, but, right, that tells you something, right? And that was something that had, now, that was a little bit of lightning in the bottle in terms of the quality and the story and all of that. But people found that, right? And now I think, you know, we're on, I think, Facebook being live streamed right now. Think about Facebook. You have content, and Facebook has the ability to go out and identify off of 2 billion people on their platform a subset of folks who actually want some of the specific content that you're delivering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you use the type of targeting that you can get from a Facebook type
to
of
develop programming
to develop
that addresses that interest?
And it becomes a feedback loop, too, by the way, right? You're able to see what people want, when they want it, how they want it, and that informs it as you go forward, all within your guardrails or at least your principles of delivering, you know, high quality, curated, independent, local, national, global, right? But you know what your principles are, and then how do you use some of these tools out there to help take it to where they are? I don't think we're in a field of dreams world anymore, where you build it and they will come.
Yeah.
Right? You have to go out there and find them, but you're finding them with something that they want.
How strong is the value of curation when you've just got volume coming in? You've got podcasts falling out of the trees. You know, there's so many. And, of course, we're very proud of our curation. It's our editorial standards. We work for them every day. But is that... But others could do that, too, who are, you know,
yeah.
Startups can do that. Other people who are aggregating can do that. And is it strong enough when, do you curate everybody who's on your system, mm-hmm. really? I mean, I've been in some Airbnb rooms that were fine for the money, but they're nothing to write home about. You know, thank you very much. I paid my money.
We're always happy to address that.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fine.
We've got a castle for you somewhere.
Okay. But I mean,
Transylvania.
Okay. Transylvania. But how strong is curation as a bulwark against being overrun by just sheer volume of new competitors who don't need radio towers?
It's a great, great question. And I think it hits on attention that I think all of us in all these spaces, you know, are challenged by, which is on one hand, you have this sort of network effect, which does take scale. 5 biggest companies in the world today are all, in effect, digital network global companies.
Network platforms,
right? And you take a look at 2001, it's a completely different set of companies that existed, mm-hmm. right? 2001 reflects the industrial age. Mm-hmm. You have 5 new ones out there of a scale that people just haven't seen.
Again, you have Facebook, Google,
right? Yeah,
Amazon.
Right? But then there's also, and you see this, you can see this in the data, you know, there's an increasing desire for that curation. So we do the curation on our platform via, you know, in effect, a digital social contract. People rate each other, right? You get,
mm-hmm.
And if you don't consistently get 4 or 5 stars, you don't stay on very long as a host or stay on very long as a...
Yeah.
I mean, I travel in hotels for 20 years. Since I've been on Airbnb, I make my bed every morning when I'm in an Airbnb. I want to make sure I continue to get my star rating.
Right.
But we use those stars to help with the curation, right?
Right.
And so I do think, I mean, my gut is that curation is going to become increasingly more important, particularly, you know, there's a story today that it's peak TV, right? This is the mm-hmm. greatest time era and mm-hmm. amount of TV mm-hmm. out there. I think mm-hmm. it's really peak information.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think one of the distinguishers, I think part of the coin of the realm will be quality. And I think quality is derived from curation. And that's where you have an advantage, a brand that already exists.
Yeah.
Talent that's in this room.
Yes.
But again, how do you start to distribute differently so that you're going out and leveraging that?
I mean, NPR is a network, but in your terms, in Silicon Valley terms, Yaron Mohn's a smart guy. He's right here. Can NPR become a network platform?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, think about...
In the current vital
I think you do some of this. You
can
tell me if I'm off on this, but I think some of this already takes place. You do some partnerships.
Oh, lots.
You know, with interesting folks doing podcasts out there. I was just talking about, you know, an idea that we were just chatting about, which is just localizing it to us, right? We're a travel and tourism-based company. There's tons of people out there now called digital nomads who are traveling the world doing their own sort of journalistic podcasts. Some are good, some aren't that good, some are great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've always thought about, wouldn't it be interesting to actually create a content distribution around some of those types of folks? Wouldn't it be interesting to do it, pitch partnership with NPR, right? We benefit from the brand of NPR.
Antenna going up right? all over the room.
We have 180
Airbnb
million people out there,
the
right? You have 30 million people here, but that content would have to be compelling content, not about promoting an Airbnb, but promoting or talking about what's going on in these fascinating places.
Would you help distribute it too?
Well, that's the point, right? So we have a distribution platform network, 180 million plus and growing. And so can you begin to look, I'm obviously just using this as a hypothetical, but are there ways to do the, that's maybe an appropriate hypothetical, but are there ways to think about things, you know, in that type of way? You know, here in San Francisco, really the Bay Area, KQED did a series of podcasts on homelessness here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Took on a life of its own. It's now one of the driving forces behind the city and regional governments actually trying to take on the issue. Not that the issue wasn't big here before,
right.
But what the KQED podcast series did was it focused on the issue in a different way, raised the whole concept of student homelessness, mm-hmm. which people hadn't necessarily really thought through.
Mm-hmm.
And how did we as a society begin? But that took on a life of its own, right? It got shared. People were sending it around. Public officials paid attention to it. So I think that there are things taking place right now where you're leveraging your brand, your curation, your quality, and then finding some of those distribution networks that you can partner with and work with.
New travel show, Airbnb as sponsor.
Yes, there you go. Look at that, huh?
Okay. You have said that what we see now in terms of disruption, this big five or six or whatever number you want to put on it, that these are just the lemonade stands out front of the disruption to come. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'll take that at a couple different levels. I'm sure many of you have heard, and Tom Friedman does a great job of describing this in his most recent book, this whole idea of Moore's Law, right? And Moore's Law is this basic concept that basically every year
we were raised
on
Moore's Law, man.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yes, every year and a half, right, your technology doubles. And, that uses the analogy of the chessboard where you put a grain of salt on each piece of the chessboard. And as it increases, right, you go from one grain to multiple tons when you get on the other side of the chessboard. And we're now on the other side of the chessboard in terms of how fast technology is moving. So every year, that doubling is just a huge multiplier. And so, you start to think about the velocity and speed in terms of which things are happening. You're not that far away. In some places, it's already happening from having your pizzas delivered by a drone. What happens when those drones are delivering marijuana, right, where it's legalized? Are they delivering it to people of age or not of age?
They won't smoke it,
right?
So they'll get it there.
Right? How about the Hyperloop, right? Hyperloop, people think, is Hyperloop will exist in some form or fashion.
Hyperloop,
which is the Hyperloop, which is
Hyperloop.
The Elon Musk technology where you can, it's basically a tunnel that you'd be able to transport through really quickly.
Like those pneumatic tubes.
Yes, people think
it's
an abstract concept. It really exists.
You can have that from San Francisco to L.A., like hop in a tube and whisk down there?
And you're there in 30 minutes, right? So think about this. You have San Francisco right now, which is a really challenging market from an affordability perspective.
Yeah.
You have a place like Stockton, which is a smaller city, about an hour and a half from here by drive, right, which is really having some challenges.
Yeah.
With a Hyperloop, right, you connect those two places. You have people who are middle class, teachers, cops, people who are middle class.
As long as people are willing to crawl
into
a tube.
And they're in the tube, right? But what are you doing? You're beginning to create a regional state, though. Right, you start to get the city states, and then the economics begin to change. Think about the ability. I mean, just from a hacking perspective, what happens when people can hack into a city's basic services?
Yeah, what does happen?
And so, I actually had a conversation recently, and I'm not going to name the person because I don't have their permission, but with a big city mayor, and I said part of the pitch to work with us is you actually need to develop the muscles to deal with this, the muscle memory.
You mean to deal with you?
To deal with all the technology that's coming.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Yeah, the kung fu too.
Yeah.
But even the way cities are set up, they don't have a data science office, right? They don't necessarily have people who've been trained in this. Even the way city councils themselves are comprised, they don't have council committees designed. They're all over, right?
So to engage
in these
coming
types of things, right, which are digital and global in their networks. And so the types of things, think about our transportation. I remember about 10 years ago.
About infrastructure a lot now.
Yeah, but I was on a board about 10 years ago, and we had a big conversation about whether we were going to build a new library. And I remember saying, a library? Like, no one's going to have libraries. They'll all fit in the cloud somewhere.
Yeah.
Stop it with that library. Right? You don't need a bricks and mortar library, though, but it's a different. And so when you think about roads now and infrastructure, in a place where there's going to be driverless cars, potentially flying cars. Again, not that far off into the future. I know people are going to hear this and think, wow, you're thinking of Jetsons, but this is coming sooner than people realize. And what happens with driverless cars when there will be no more traffic, but there will be a lot more green spaces? Are you going to still build parking garages right now, and you're going to spend public money on that, which is not going to have any use in 4 or 5 years?
Four or five years.
Yeah, are you bonding off of the revenue that you're getting from those traffic garages right now to do other building in your city that's not going to exist?
You better do it now.
Right. So thinking about all of those things in a pretty holistic way at a time when these cities are already under, you know, enormous pressure. I do think they're becoming laboratories of democracy, because ultimately, with the dysfunction at the federal level, they're having to figure this stuff out on their own. But you know, all this stuff is happening incredibly fast right now. And I do think, sorry, this is a long answer, but
I think
that part of our challenges with democracy do come to the fact that technology is moving too quickly. I mean, it's enriched our lives in so many ways, helped save lives, connected us in a global sense. But it is ahead of government right now. And government is having a real difficult time to deal with it. Ultimately, private sector has to take a lot of responsibility to make this work, and obviously partner with government, because you do need rules to make sure society works and so that there is trust in society. But right now, I do think that one of the challenges that our democratic institutions are facing is that technology has gotten too far ahead.
Active question in Washington, particularly under this administration and congressional majority right now, in this world, where Amazon and Airbnb, you guys are just the lemonade stand for the change to come, where there's so many digital sources of information, does the country still need public broadcasting?
And more so than ever.
Why?
I think, you know, not to be repetitive, but first of all, the reasons that we talked about earlier, which is I do think that people need information that they can agree on, you know, as being accurate. You know, earlier we had touched on the millennials. You know, there had been this concept in the U.S. really from end of World War II up until maybe the early 80s of the Hartz box, right? And this was this idea that there was a general consensus out there. Mm-hmm. You know, left and the right were within that box for the most part, but there was a general acceptance of what needed to be done, an ethos that government had a role to play, and a common sense of facts that people more or less, you know, agreed to. Millennials actually do have that. It's different. It's not left. It's not right. You know, they may be a little bit more sort of libertarian on economic issues, mm-hmm. but very progressive on social issues, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to be different, but there's a general consensus, regardless of where you are in the country, on millennials. And I think those millennials in particular, and I do think, and I don't have any data, you probably do, but I do think that one of the reasons you're seeing so much interest from millennials in public broadcasting, public news, public, you know, public television, is because there is a consensus and they're looking for a place that is actually going to give them some facts that they can operate on. You know, right now, I think one of our challenges is that so much stuff is segmented, right? You can get up in the morning, listen to MSNBC, listen to your podcast, listen to Fox, listen to your podcast, right? You typically live in a precinct or district where people look and think like you, right? You come back and, you know, if you, I'm sure, turn on MSNBC or Fox and two different versions of reality. Mm-hmm. It's hard for democracy to function there. And so ultimately, I do think that we will self-heal and self-help on this, and a big part of that will be a robust fourth estate that becomes a center of truth, and I think, you know, NPR is right at the epicenter of that.
Chris Lehane, Airbnb is lucky to have you. We are lucky to have had you with us today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Chris Lehane, Airbnb.
That was On Point host Tom Ashbrook talking with Airbnb's Chris Lehane yesterday in San Francisco.